You're listening to part two of episode 671 of Unwelcome Guests. We continue with Helen Caldicott's speech.
Okay, now I want to talk to you about what happens in the food. All of these elements and more landed all over Japan and Europe. When, say, cesium lands on the ground, the grass and the rice suck it up and concentrate it about 10 to 100 times compared to the background level. And then the cow comes along, and I can't draw a cow, except that that's the active organ of the cow, the udder. And the cow eats the grass, and it concentrates more, like 100 times, in the cow's milk and the meat. And then a lactating woman drinks the cow's milk, and it concentrates more in her breast. And as it passes through the breast to feed the baby, it can mutate a cell in the breast that can later cause breast cancer. And then the tiny baby is drinking the milk, and this concentrates most highly in the baby. And babies are so sensitive to radiation. So that's called biomagnification in the food chain. And I can't tell you, but so much of the Fukushima food is radioactive. And I heard that they're bringing Fukushima food here and selling it and advertising it, saying it's a good thing to eat. That is criminal. That's like saying, do you want some poison? Ooh, here's some nice poison. Don't worry, you won't get your cancer for 20 years. The government here does not understand. And we have to teach the government and you what the dangers are. That's why we're here. Now, in the sea, or huge amounts of radiation are still being released into the Pacific, like untold amounts. So it gets concentrated in the algae, then in the crustaceans, then in the little fish, and then in the big fish, and then us. So that's what happens in the food chain. And of course, you can't taste it. It's invisible. And it takes so long to get cancer, except it's faster in children and babies. I'm a pediatrician, and I care deeply about the future for our children, or even now. And you know, the radioactive waste that is piling up, you've got huge amounts of it. You've got 2 more years of storage. I don't know what the total amount is, but in the world, there are about 100,000 tons of this waste coming out of the reactors. 30 tons from each reactor every year. Tons. So, where are you going to put it? You have to store it safely, isolated from the environment for 1 million years. No container, concrete, steel, lasts longer than 100 years. And as these containers rust and fall apart, so the radioactive elements get out and get into the water and start concentrating in the food. And I can imagine generations hence, the people waking up in the morning, the breast milk is already radioactive, the food's radioactive, the babies are being born deformed, and I've got pictures of deformed children from Chernobyl. There are homes full of the most grossly deformed children with no legs and no arms and tiny little heads and tiny little eyes or one eye. And the babies being born deformed and children getting cancer at the age of 6 instead of 60 because they're exposed to radioactive elements in utero. And an increased incidence of genetic disease, much of it lethal. That's the legacy we leave to our descendants. Now, I know Confucius says that one must venerate the elders. But for me as a doctor and a pediatrician, yeah, elders must be venerated, and I like that too because I'm 75. But the most important people in our society are the children and our descendants. What is the legacy we are leaving to our descendants? And that's more important than the elders. I'm sorry. And that's what we must venerate, our children and our genes and our sperm and our eggs, and protect them for the rest of time. This is a public health issue greater than smoking, because smoking only kills the smoker. Nuclear power is going to kill people forevermore. Now, you have to educate your politicians and say, if you don't close those reactors down, no more reactors in Taiwan, and close them down, we won't vote you into office. But we have to educate people, all the people in Taiwan, through the media. And the doctors have to talk, because it's a medical issue. That's all it is. It's a medical issue. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott. She spoke on nuclear power, radiation, and our health to a group of concerned mothers in Taipei, Taiwan, in July 2013. Mom Loves Taiwan is an anti-nuclear group that opposes the construction of a fourth nuclear power plant on the island of Taiwan. Helen Caldicott also responded to the question, what evidence we have of genetic damage caused within the exclusion zones of Chernobyl and now of Fukushima. Professor Timothy Mousseau teaches in the Biological Sciences Department at the University of South Carolina.
There's a very good biologist who's been looking at the birds and the insects in the exclusion zones around Fukushima and Chernobyl. And these areas are very radioactive, and they're finding mutations in the birds. White feathers, abnormalities here, a strange beak, crooked tail feathers, and the birds are developing cataracts in their eyes. And after Chernobyl, many people got cataracts and couldn't see, because that's what radiation does. We're seeing it in the birds already. These are firebugs, and you can see they're mutant. Their antennae are crooked, or one is missing. Some legs are missing. And also, you can see the faces, eyes and nose and mouth, but they're all different. So these firebugs have been mutated. Do you all understand? What happens to firebugs, what happens to birds, happens to us. And the birds he studies, the swallows, have smaller brains than normal. Many of the male birds are sterile. They can't reproduce. And they've got a lot of tumours. Therefore, this is an indication of what the future holds for us. And this is pioneering work. This man will get the Nobel Prize for the work he's doing. It's going to change radiation standards. But he's also at risk, because he's going into very radioactive areas. He's a very, very brave biologist, putting his own life at risk.
Helen Caldicott praising the work of Professor Timothy Mousseau. He was one of the scientists who gave a presentation at the Fukushima Symposium organized by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and Physicians for Social Responsibility in New York City in March 2013. Mousseau's half-hour talk can be heard or downloaded free from TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the Fukushima Symposium. Mousseau's full talk also has a very concise rebuttal of the popular reports that claim that the exclusion zone around Chernobyl is a wildlife paradise. Mousseau says that there are no scientific studies backing that claim, and his own work and experience show the opposite. He says it is rather a PR gimmick by the pro-nuclear forces, as well as by the Ukrainian government. The Ukraine wants to benefit from nuclear tourism. Recently, they built a small zoo so travelers can take pictures of a wolf or wild boar through the fence. In her public appearance in Taiwan, Helen Caldicott was asked when she first became concerned about nuclear radiation. She said that as a young woman, she was deeply moved by a book set in her hometown of Melbourne. Neville Shute's On the Beach was later made into a movie.
I lived in Melbourne, Australia, and I read a book called On the Beach by Neville Shute, and it was about a nuclear war that occurred by accident, and everyone in the world was killed. But the people in Melbourne, because it's so far south, were still alive, and gradually they waited for the radioactive cloud to come down, and the government dispensed cyanide capsules so parents could kill their babies like that instead of dying of the revolting vomiting and diarrhea and bleeding to death. At the end of that book, the beautiful, elegant streets of Melbourne were still there. A blind was gently flapping in the breeze, and that was the end of life on Earth. And that image never left me. Then I went to medical school age 17, and I learnt about a man called Müller, who irradiated with X-rays Drosophila fruit flies, and they developed mutations for crooked wings and abnormal legs, which were passed on generation to generation. And I knew then Russia and America were blowing up bombs in the atmosphere with no heed to what the radiation would do to people, and I couldn't understand what these men thought they were doing. And I still can't understand it. And I still can't understand why they think nuclear power is a glorious thing. Nuclear power plants are actually bomb factories. And sometimes they explode, like Chernobyl. And sometimes they just melt down. But the same elements that are released when you blow up bombs are made in nuclear power plants. So all my life I've been concerned, and not until 1971 when I found out that the French were blowing up their bombs at Muro Atoll in the Pacific, and we got a lot of fallout in Adelaide where I lived, that I wrote a letter to the newspaper, and they published it, and that night I was asked to speak on television about how children could get leukemia from strontium 90 and cancers. And every time the French blew up another bomb, there I was on television. And in 9 months, 75% of Australians rose up en masse, spontaneous marches in the city streets. Postmen wouldn't deliver French mail. People stopped buying French wine or French cheese. So our Prime Minister and the New Zealand Prime Minister took France to the International Court of Justice, and she was forced to test underground. So I saw what President Jefferson said: an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott. She was recorded at her July 7, 2013 visit to Taipei, Taiwan. The anti-nuclear organization Mom Loves Taiwan invited her to talk on nuclear power, radiation, and our health. They are concerned about the ongoing emissions from the nearby Fukushima reactors, since the cleanup, according to TEPCO, will take at least 50 years. They also fear that a second serious accident will be triggered by a major earthquake or tsunami.
Now, the concluding piece from TUC Radio's mini-series on the health effects of the ongoing Fukushima disaster is not about Fukushima itself, but about the radioactive fallout from Chernobyl and the difficulty of estimating the cancers and health effects caused by that, and the responses of the powers that be to being presented with such stark evidence. For an establishment view on the health impacts of nuclear radiation, I sometimes go to Wikipedia, and on this occasion I was informed that the Fukushima accident killed nobody and injured 39. Now, the subject of how many people are going to die over their lifetime as a result of the radiation released is certainly unclear. Wikipedia gives prominence to a study which suggests it might be 130 people, and the article on Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster casualties concludes with the reassuring sentence that these numbers are very low compared to the estimated 20,000 casualties caused by the tsunami itself, and it's been estimated that if Japan had never adopted nuclear power, accidents and pollution from coal or gas plants would have caused more lost years of life. So, very reassuring stuff there, if you believe Wikipedia. And the Chernobyl article, for reference, doesn't include a statement on deaths, although it mentions the official Soviet casualty count of 31 deaths, and a lot of discussion about long-term deaths. Now, that article gives prominence to the WHO's prediction of 4,000 cancer deaths in the surrounding countries. Although, to be fair, it does mention a 2009 paper, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and Environment, which suggests that 985,000 premature deaths are a result of the radioactivity released. As we've heard several times on the show before, notably from Chris Busby, the powers that be have adopted a very simplistic model for the health impacts of radiation, and it suits their interests not to replace it with a more biologically and scientifically accurate one, because that would increase the deaths due to cancer. Now, our last presentation from Maria Geladen this week is by Vladimir Vertiletsky. He's presenting the results of Ukraine's Congenital Malformations Monitoring Program, 10 years of scientific study of the birth defects of children and the possible connection to the radiation released by the Chernobyl nuclear disaster.
Vladimir Vertiletsky was born in Poland in 1936. He trained in pediatrics at Washington University and in clinical genetics at the Harvard School of Medicine. From 1968 to 1970, he served as senior surgeon of the United States Public Health Service. From 1974 to 2010, he was chair in the Department of Medical Genetics at the University of South Alabama. Now retired, he's dedicated to contributing to a clearer scientific and public understanding of the global impacts of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in 1986. He was recorded on March 12, 2013, by Pacifica Radio at the New York Academy of Medicine. The Fukushima Symposium presented 2 days of medicine, environmental science, and nuclear engineering related to the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. The Helen Caldicott Foundation organized the event, which was co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. Here's Vladimir Vertiletsky.
This is the third analysis, and is the very first time after 10 years where we start letting some results out, because the issue is credibility of the data. For general, those who teach and have students or young researchers, I think the news releases by the WHO or the IAEA are masterpieces of language manipulation. So I would like to call your attention that IAEA now is basically behind WHO, so their declarations now are given to the young people in the name of the World Health Organization, to which they should trust. Because if they don't trust the World Health Organization, then how can they trust much else? This work required cooperation of many people, many more than I can mention, and you can find out what is this OmniNet in the web. And it involves international and Ukrainian colleagues. We have participants in the international group that are most of them focused on alcohol, because alcohol is a teratogen, and a teratogen is any cause, environmental cause, that can create malformations or developmental problems. And in Ukraine, alcohol is a fairly common universal teratogen. So if you don't take that into account, you're going to get confused with another universal teratogen, which is ionizing radiation. And most of that is done pro bono, and if not pro bono, none of it is done connected with government or the nuclear power industry. I also want to tell you that data is data, and good data is good data, and the gold standard is this one. It's the Hiroshima-Nagasaki studies by Dr. James Neal. And it's not only about cancer and cancer and cancer, it is also about congenital malformations. But I want to stress that these studies are not about teratogens. They are about gene mutations, which is completely different to what we are going to be talking about. I also want to point out that the radiation model, in our view, from Hiroshima Nagasaki, is irrelevant to the Chernobyl situation because the ionizing radiation in Rivne is chronic, not acute. It's not a blast, but it's a continuous drip. Is not gamma or neutrons, but is mainly beta type of radiation. It is not external, but it is inhaled or swallowed. And the people that were studied that then had children 2 years later in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, those parents were exposed to radiation, but their children that were conceived in a radiation-free environment. Nobody in his right mind went down to the hypocenter to conceive a child. All these people conceived children after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So we convened a meeting exactly on the fifth anniversary of the Ukrainian independence. 1996, World Congress of Human Genetics. We got together in Rio de Janeiro, and we decided to try. Well, as you know, there is a situation of power change. After Chernobyl, 5 years later, Ukraine decided to leave the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union collapses. There is a creation of a new government. There's a power struggle between points of view. And in that environment, we tried to start an international program based on international standards to establish a population registry of every child born and every child examined. And that started in 2000. Now, the terms Chernobyl you already know. Polisia is a region of Rivne. Polishchuks are the native people from Polisia. And Rivne is one of the 28 provinces of Ukraine. And we decided that we need to use international standards, so we said, okay, we're going to join the European Congenital Malformation Monitoring System, and we're going to make Ukraine a member of that system, and they are welcome to come and check the data. So we established teams across Ukraine. And slowly, to quickly accumulate data, we were doing population monitoring, still do, in more than one province. And we quickly noticed that there is a departure of certain rates. And if you look at neural tube defects, Eurocat reports 10.2, we begin to see 18.5. And we notice anencephaly goes higher and microcephaly is higher, and anophthalmia is higher. So it's a hypothesis. Let's then see what we can do. Let's put our very limited resources and crank it up. Then we realized that maybe we should concentrate on the dirtiest of the provinces. The northern half of the province geologically is different. It has no clay, virtually. No binders. So the radiation that fell, plus the index of transfer of that radiation to woods, to trees, to nutrients, to grass, is so much higher that, in effect, this is more contaminated than Zhytomyr, which is right next to Chernobyl. So this is the most contaminated area in Ukraine. And we also notice that the northern three counties are of particular interest. They are the most isolated, and I will come back to that. And they have seasonal flooding, just like in Louisiana. And that gives legs to a lot of radiation. It can move. So it's an ecologic isolate, it's a population isolate. As an isolate, they marry each other. And it has the highest index of transfer of cesium from soil to plant. And they have to eat or die from hunger, because they can't go anywhere to buy food. They can't go anywhere to heat, or else they freeze, so they burn radioactive wood. So, to summarize, special population, special ecology, special radiation, well, we have a real niche, ideal for multidisciplinary long-term studies of health impacts of anything. So we are not after selling that radiation is the only problem. We don't want children with congenital malformations, whatever the cause. So after confirmation, we are now starting this sort of presentations. And I'm going only to talk about Polesia and Rivne, and only to talk about two or three anomalies, because as you know, there are 500 of them. And we did, at the same time, surveys to try to narrow down what could be the cause. But this is description. This is descriptive epidemiology, which is not designed to prove cause-effect. It is only designed to prove what's going on. So, we know that the neural tube defects in Polesia are the highest in Europe. And that's up to Eurocat to say no. They are funded by the European Union to do exactly that. We also know that microcephaly is the highest in Europe. And so is microphthalmia. Three anomalies that are known to be associated with either alcohol or both ionizing radiation, but there are little differences. So naturally, we were very lucky to have one of the longest NIH-funded projects to detect early as possible, fetal alcohol syndromes before birth of these children. So we start with teratogenic risks. Let's start with alcohol. That's where the money is. That's where the bank is. That's where the NIH pays for people to do. So we do. And we conclude that that cannot be an explanation of what we see in Polesia. So we see a couple of thousand women, a considerable effort, we screen them, and we demonstrate that actually in Polesia, these women that are pregnant drink much less, not much more, than the other women that live in different cities. Secondly, we look at where do we find FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and we find many more elsewhere. So the rates are higher away from Polesia than in Polesia. So we now look at radiation. Well, we don't have money, we don't have expertise, you are the experts, we are just plain pediatricians. We are pedestrian pediatricians. So, but we know that radiation has legs and they get mobilized regularly. The fires occur every summer. One kind of tree has 20 times as much radiation per kilogram than another kind of tree, so there's no point in generalizing. A burning pine is different from a burning willow, different organisms. And 76% of them heat and cook by burning wood and then take the ash and fertilize their little home garden. So they keep concentrating and concentrating. So actually the concentrations are higher now than they were 15 years ago, because the bioconcentration takes time. And so the pregnant women do the easy task. They go and burn dried potato stems. The potato harvest is do or die. Potato is a central element of nutrition. So what do? We collect these plants and look at what's in them. So if a woman can incorporate radiation, can a potato? I presume it can incorporate. So we look, and to our surprise, we find strontium. We don't believe it. We run it again. And there it is. So we have a ratio of how much cesium to strontium. But all the measures and all the public health is based on cesium. We ignore strontium, and strontium for a fetus is much more important than we believe, because potassium is everywhere, but strontium has to go to specialized enzymes and skeletons and teeth and dentin and all kinds of other things, and is going to stay with that child until it dies. So it's going to be radiating. The potassium, they'll be urinating it out, the cesium. But the strontium, once you got you, it stays where it is. Now, we take 20,000 people, 20,000 measurements of whole body counts. It's a little bit, a lot of work. And we find that 48% of women in those three counties are above what the Ministry of Health says is safe. So here it is. Now, how sensitive is a fetus? Shall we compute a woman as an adult, although she is pregnant, or shall we focus on the sensitivity of the fetus? I don't know of a single citation, if you do, please give me, of what is the sensitivity of a fetus. We say a child has 3,800 becquerels upper limit, and an adult 11,453 and three quarters. But how much does the fetus have? So here we are stuck. We did not expect to find things. We simply followed the lead. And now we have microcephaly, not alcohol. This is descriptive epidemiology, but also has to be logical. So let's check. Maybe we miss minor effects, minor reductions of the head size, because we did a very strict definition of microcephaly of 3 standard deviations or less. Otherwise, you are not microcephalic. You can be very, very retarded and have epilepsy and have a very small head. But if it's not 3 standard deviations, we don't count you. But now let's do the other way. Let's measure all the heads. So this is a comparison of about 15,000 measurements at birth. And to our surprise, no difference in birth weights, but a statistically significant reduction of head size in those three counties. What are you going to do with that? But it's known radiation effect on the nervous system. So we have arrived basically at the end of the trip. So what do? We cannot say that this study is cause and effect. This study is a descriptive study. But we do provide a foundation for cause and effect. We have a specific population, we have a specific pattern of malformations, and we have a specific geographic area. We have a population registry of every baby born in the last 10 years, with name of the mother and everything else. So, what do we conclude? Either we are not talking about reality, and I wouldn't be here. We waited for 3 analyses. Those who think that this is unreal, whether they are IAEA or whoever, they are welcome to come and check the data. Or these malformations are there, but they are not due to radiation. So that those whole body counts of pregnant women and potatoes and all that, that's totally irrelevant. Prove it. Let's prove it. I think that's important enough to dismiss it with some prospective case control or whatever other epidemiologic studies you wish. Not this one. This one opens the key and the door to facilitate and expedite such an investigation. Or maybe the fetus is far more sensitive than the standards we apply to it. And finally, maybe actually the doses are not what they said to be. And probably all of these factors, plus alcohol, plus malnutrition, plus lack of folate acid, and plus of so many birth defects, congenital malformations require the convergence of two things. Multiple things that disrupt the development and multiple things that disrupt the repair of the damage, because we have regenerative capabilities. So you have this balance, and if it is unbalanced, then the morphogenesis of the embryo becomes altered. There are all kinds of things that the world needs to know, because these birth defects occur in China and Indonesia, India and anywhere else, and the more we know, the better we're going to prevent them. So what I want to tell you is that as a physician, prevention is first, not epidemiology. And we know how to prevent. We know that in China, this is J.R. Berry, a good friend, who spent part of his life, his children went to school in China in order to do this. He proved conclusively that you can reduce 50% or more neurotube defects by one pill that costs, you can get folic acid, about 60 pills for 60 days for the price of one pack of cigarettes. So it is an immediate need to act. And we have been working with the government, and yes, tomorrow, yes, tomorrow, yes, tomorrow. It needs to be done, I agree. But secondly, these people don't need to be exposed to radiation because they don't need to swallow it. Give them milk, give them potatoes, give them flour, but bring it from somewhere else. The authorities have enough resources and know-how to do it today. But if international partnerships step in, that's more likely, and it's more likely to be done better. And the existing monitoring can show, not just to Ukraine, but the world, all the nuances of prevention. For instance, is folic acid going to prevent neurotube defects when you have a bunch of people exposed to radiation, or is it going to be totally ineffective? And if it is effective, would it be effective in Fukushima, regardless if they have spina bifida or not? Should Fukushima exposed people get folic acid? Those are questions that transcend Ukraine and call for solidarity. And Western Europe needs to learn a little bit more, because we are the only program unfunded by the European Union. There are 39 programs. We are the only ones who don't get a penny to monitor congenital malformations that they publish. And if Chernobyl is not relevant to Europe and congenital malformation threat, I'm confused.
And I would echo that sentiment that the role of organized money is important in deciding which findings are emphasized and possibly determining the findings of research, certainly in deciding which studies get carried out, which questions get left unanswered. Now, what possible justification is there for leaving the disaster mitigation in the hands of TEPCO? Do we think the commercial imperative is helpful as far as disaster mitigation and prevention? TEPCO admitted in October last year that it had failed to take stronger measures to prevent disasters in case that incited legal action against them, and because it could add momentum to anti-nuclear movements. Why then is this company still in charge? Is the answer perhaps ideological? The powers that be don't want to have to admit that commercial organizations cannot be trusted in matters of safety. I think we need some explanation of why the public have been so uninformed about what's actually going on at Fukushima. And by the way, the situation as far as safety and nuclear power plants doesn't seem to be any better in the US, from what I've gathered. Seems to be a lot of potential disasters looming there because of the commercial imperative to cut corners. Now, our last piece this week is not from the nuclear industry in Japan, but if you're an American, it's closer to home. It's about fire safety and the health risks of flame retardants. A larger point is a clash between ethical, considerate, morally responsible, legal behavior, which we would like to see from companies, and the commercial imperative, which says actually it's selfish gain that's the most important, and those companies most proficient at accumulating money are ipso facto those companies which should be allowed to prosper and to take over other companies less focused on selfish gain. This interview was carried out by Amy Grunder on the 1st of December 2012.
I'm Amy Grunder. A study published Wednesday in the journal Environmental Science and Technology reports high concentrations of toxic flame retardants in American homes. Scientists at Silent Spring Institute, who authored the study, have found that flame retardants in common household products like upholstered furniture, textiles, and electronics migrate into household dust and from there into our bodies. The Chicago Tribune reported that the average American is born with the highest recorded levels of flame retardants among infants in the world. The chemicals are linked to cancer, changes in DNA, hormone disruption, lowered IQ, decreased fertility, and hyperactivity. Such links are denied by chemical producers who have lobbied for years to get these chemicals into consumer products. We're joined today by Ruth Ann Rudell, Senior Scientist of Environmental Toxicology and Director of Research at the Silent Spring Institute, a nonprofit organization based in Newton, Massachusetts, that works to identify and break the links between toxins and women's health, especially breast cancer. Ms. Rudell is a leader in studies of environmental pollutants and women's health. Since 1995, she's focused on toxicology, risk assessment, and exposure assessment, including a focus on endocrine-disrupting compounds. We'll learn what that is in just a moment. They are chemicals that affect hormones. Ruth Ann Rudell, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you join us, as this study just came out on Wednesday, and I'd like to start with the study itself. Your scientists collected and analyzed dust found in California homes. What prompted this focus on household dust, and what did you find?
Sure. We have been doing research on how people are exposed to chemicals that are in consumer goods, building materials, and products. And we spend most of our time indoors. Concentrations of a lot of chemicals are actually a lot higher indoors than outdoors. And so for over a decade, we've been measuring indoor air in house dust as ways to look at how people are exposed to chemicals in consumer products. And we've focused particularly on chemicals that are known to affect hormones called endocrine disruptors. So these might be some chemicals like in plastics, like phthalates, that block androgen hormone or testosterone action, basically, or some other chemicals that cleaners that, or in lotions that mimic estrogen, or fragrance chemicals that mimic estrogen. So when we started this work, in fact, we were doing it in Massachusetts, and among the chemicals that we looked for a set of flame retardant chemicals called PBDEs, or polybrominated diphenyl ethers, in the house dust. And when we found them,
those are the flame retardants, right?
Those are flame retardants. Sorry if I didn't say that. And when we found them, it was the first report of these chemicals in the U.S., and they were about 10 times higher, the levels were, than a few reports that had come out of Europe.
This was in Boston, Ruth Ann Rudell?
This was in Cape Cod. This was Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and Silent Spring Institute was doing a big exposure study there focused on indoor exposures to hormone-active compounds. And then we expanded the study, and we went to California, and we collected some house dust samples in two different communities in the Bay Area, and we looked for the same flame retardants, these PBDE flame retardants, and to our surprise, the levels in California were another 10 times higher than the levels in Massachusetts in our previous study. And also in the intervening period, some other researchers had done other studies in the U.S. The California levels were higher than than any of the other U.S. levels.
Now, the culprit there was California law, wasn't it?
And right, that's what. So we also looked at some blood levels that are collected by the Centers for Disease Control that allow a sort of a national comparison. We found that Californians have twice the level of these compounds in their blood compared to other folks in the rest of the U.S. And then tied that to a unique California flammability furniture flammability standard. It's a law in California and that says that foam in furniture has to withstand an open flame for 12 seconds without igniting. And we have furniture here in Massachusetts, in Boston, that meets that standard, and you probably have seen it, the tag on furniture that says, like, not to be removed except by consumer, meets California Bureau of Home Furnishings, blah, 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 Technical Bulletin 117. Anyway, that's the law. And that particular regulation, which was enacted in the 70s, essentially drove a huge market for these penta-BDEs, which filled foam, were added to furniture foam, especially in California, but many manufacturers would make their furniture meet that standard throughout the U.S. instead of making two different kinds of furniture. And so those penta-BDE flame retardants have now been banned. They were banned in Europe and banned in several states, and eventually the manufacturers withdrew them. But what they did is they substituted some other chemicals for them. And in this new study, the one that we just released this week, what we did is go back to homes 5 years after this change, the same homes that we went to before, and we took new samples. And we measured now about 49 different kinds of flame retardants in the house dust sample. So we went beyond this PBDEs, which have been the focus of study, and we looked at a whole slew of them. And some of the most important ones to keep in mind are
Firemaster 550, right?
Firemaster 550 is one. So Firemaster 550 is the formulation that the manufacturers that withdrew the PBDEs have introduced as a substitute. And what we saw is over the 5 years between 2006 and 2011, we can see the levels of Firemaster 550 going up in these homes, while PBDE levels stay the same or go down slightly.
The PBDE was the one that was in children's pajamas. Is that right?
So then the children's pajamas is a whole another family of these flame retardants, and those are called, so we can call them TRIS, brominated TRIS and chlorinated TRIS. The brominated TRIS was used in children's pajamas in the 1970s until it was banned because it was determined to be a carcinogen.
So now we have this new one. So then we had the PBDEs, and then we got the Firemaster 550.
Yep.
And you're finding it turning up at the same rates as whatever you found before? Something like 75% of the homes you tested?
We did find the brominated TRIS that's been banned from the kids' pajamas, and we also found its sibling, let's call it, chlorinated TRIS, which is also carcinogen, and that was one of the chemicals that we found in the highest concentrations in the homes. One of our major conclusions really from this research in terms of stepping back from the details is that the manufacturers of flame retardants have consistently used products that are known to be carcinogens or hazardous in some other way, and substituted either known bad chemicals essentially, or chemicals that nobody has tested to see what they do.
So you get one, you get rid of one, then you get another. Right. What kind of products contain this stuff? We're talking about couches, mattresses, rugs, toys, electronics, cosmetics. Why would you put flame retardants in cosmetics? I saw that reference. Brominated vegetable oil in Mountain Dew and Gatorade. Is that bromine. Yeah. Is that chlorine? Is that a flame retardant?
Those are, you know, it's not, it's a, like a close cousin. I'm actually not an expert on the brominated vegetable oil, but I did read that also, right. And it caused my eyebrows to go up.
Mine as well. But you focused on dust in this study. So how does this stuff, so we're right, surrounded stuff, by these products, right?
And doesn't then, matter, right. Doesn't, you know, we have the products. So some of the main sources would be the foam inside foam furniture and foam padding underneath wall-to-wall carpet. You know that foam that they put underneath? Yeah.
I have it in my house.
Yeah. That is the main source of many of these. Electronics, the plastics of electronics also contain flame retardants, but usually they're, And then some textiles, you can still, kids' pajamas are often still treated. They're treated with, not with brominated tris, because that's not allowed on there, but they're treated with other flame retardants. So there are a lot of uses, and there's, you know, a couple interesting, one thing to think about is why do we, you know, obviously we don't want to burn up, and we don't want to have dangerous fires, and so...
Can we talk about the role of big tobacco? Did you see the study in the Chicago Tribune, that series?
The Chicago Tribune did an amazing expose.
Yes, and everyone should look for it.
Anyone who's interested in this topic should really read it. It's a fantastic set of articles about showing that since cigarettes were starting a lot of fires and there was some pressure on tobacco to produce fire-safe cigarettes, and tobacco industry was worried that they wouldn't be able to produce fire-safe cigarettes, essentially cigarettes that would go out if you stopped drawing on them, that people wouldn't like them. And so,
like American spirits.
Yeah. They instead decided to push for laws that would make furniture less flammable. And in doing this, they partnered with the three large companies that produce flame retardants, and they set up a front group called Citizens for Fire Safety that looked like a group that was trying to enact good fire safety regulations, but in fact was bankrolled just by these three big flame retardant manufacturing companies, and was being worked on by tobacco lobbyists to essentially try to get the California standard or similar standards enacted in more and more places, increasing their market for their flame retardants.
Right, and apparently they also, they mobilized the Association of Top Fire Officials to campaign for the use of fire retardants, even though it made fires more dangerous for firefighters. We're talking about millions of dollars here. I'm looking for the study now. I'm not actually finding the numbers, but I wonder if you could say something about the effect that this kind of money has had on regulation and who actually regulates these chemicals.
Yeah, I guess two points that are important. One is that over the last 5 years, particularly since the PBDEs have been banned and gotten more attention, there's been a movement to try to modify or change TB-117 in California and make it change the standard so that it won't require use of these chemicals. It might provide for alternate means of achieving fire safety. And apparently what I've read is that the flame retardant industry spent over $23 million trying to successfully fighting any effort to modify TB-117. However, California Governor Jerry Brown has now made a pledge to take a look at it. So that is hopeful.
Isn't there the 1976 Toxic Substances Control Act?
That's the national law,
isn't it?
That's the national law, and that's actually, I think, really a very important focus, especially coming about out of our study, where we measured 44 different flame retardant chemicals, and really most of them have a pretty bad safety profile if you dig up the research about it. And so why do we have all of these chemicals? Why is it okay for companies to put, you know, very large quantities of these chemicals into consumer products to the point that they get into house dust? In fact, we found chemicals in house dust, carcinogens and neurotoxins and developmental toxins at levels above what EPA guidelines would, EPA kind of health safety guidelines. So it's not that these exposures are inconsequential or don't matter, which is what the American Chemistry Council loves to say in their defense. In fact, that the exposures are at a level of concern, you know, for human health. And a study that just came out 2 weeks ago from California found that moms' PBDE levels in their blood during pregnancy...
That's the flame retardant, right?
That's that flame retardant. Were associated with their kids' IQ, attentiveness, and motor behavior. So that's one of the biggest studies so far that's shown, you know, actually shown health effects in a human population, which is not that easy to do.
We have time for maybe one last question, and I'd like to go exactly to that point where you said it's not that easy to do. The American Chemistry Council, which is the largest industry group representing the producers of these companies, basically said about your study, there's no data in this study that indicates that levels of flame retardants would cause any human health problems. Could you respond to that?
It's just wrong. We had two levels of evidence that they're of health concern. One is that the levels in dust are actually higher than EPA health-based guidelines for soil at Superfund sites. And second, that this recent study showed that flame retardant levels in moms and their kids are associated with decrements in IQ, the higher the mom's exposure was.
Well, could you say something about the difficulty of your work, which the focus of your work is researching the effect of environmental toxins on women's health, particularly links between these toxins and breast cancer. And that has to be challenging because it's not a controlled study in a laboratory or something, right?
Right. Well, here we get to, you know, standards of evidence and what is considered evidence and what kind of evidence is achievable. And I guess since we don't have much time, I think the main point I would make to listeners is that often you'll hear medical professionals as well as the American Chemistry Council, you know, when somebody says, I'm concerned about that such, you know, flame retardants cause this or that or, you know, IQ, they'll say, well, there's no evidence. In fact, what would that evidence look like? What kind of evidence could we get? And when we talk about medical evidence, it's often from a randomized clinical trial. And that would mean taking, you know, a cohort and a bunch of newborn babies, and half of them we would expose them at birth and half of them we wouldn't expose them.
Great.
And then we'd follow them to see what would happen. Well, we don't do that kind of experiment. That's not an ethical experiment to do with an environmental pollutant. So we have to do observational studies, and so the evidence looks a little different. And in some cases, we're not going to ever be able to do an observational study that's going to be convincing. When breast cancer is a multifactorial disease, many factors contribute to it, and it could be exposures in utero that affect breast cancer risk 60, 70 years later. So we need to use other methods, and in particular use predictive toxicology. That's look at animal models and see how chemicals act in the animal models and make decisions based on that to protect people.
Thank you for joining us, Ruthann Rudell. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Ruthann Rudell, Senior Scientist of Environmental Toxicology and Director of Research at the Silent Spring Institute, which authored a new study in the journal Environment, Science, and Technology reporting high concentrations of toxic flame retardants in American homes.
This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests, formerly weekly, will now be coming out fortnightly. If you would like to assist in production, course, you're welcome to contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Right.